Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Rhonda Ortiz. She's a former Church of God. She came to the church in 2024, and we're honored to have her here. She's a novelist and an editor of some really neat projects that we'll talk about a little later on in the program. But Rhonda, it's so great to have you here.
It's great to have you. Thank you for having me. Excuse me.
Absolutely. You're here to tell your story and probably talk a little bit about the story itself later on. Mm-hmm. I know you're involved in some great literary projects as well as some writing projects of your own. And so, you know, the concept of story, you know, and sharing your own story and the arc of that, you know, as we were chatting about it before the show. Mm-hmm. It's a great thing. So thanks for being here to share your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, let me step out of the way, go way back to the beginning. How does your story begin?
Well, thank you. So I am a native Oregonian. Okay. And mom, dad, three kids, one of three, I'm the oldest. And I was raised Church of God, as you mentioned. So this is the Anderson, Indiana, you know, more Wesleyan tradition. Okay. It came out of the Holiness Movement in the 1800s. It's a Protestant ecumenical movement and has continued, the association has continued since then. My dad was Church of Christ. My mom was raised very nominally Presbyterian. Okay. And they, neither one of them were practicing any, you know, going to church when I was very small. Okay. And when I was seven, I was on a soccer team with the pastor's son from the church we ended up growing up in. So, and that's how we ended up in church. And it was a really wonderful community of faith. They taught me about Jesus. They baptized me. I had a very profound experience in my baptism. I do remember that very, very clearly, and had a very, as I look back on it, I think, very clear understanding of the sacrament and the power of the sacrament, and how that was working in my life.
Right.
So, yeah, I was very involved. Mm-hmm. Growing up, you know, youth group, everything that you would think, you know, a good Christian girl would be involved in.
What does worship look like for the Church of God?
You know, a general, you know, I think what people think of evangelical worship.
Scripture teaching.
Scripture teaching, hymns.
Hymns, okay.
You know, praise music, that
All
sort
right.
of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it was very interesting. You know, again, I was a very, as I was thinking back, you know, what in the journey, how did this lead to the church? Mm. I would say that I had a prodigal daughter story. And I started out as a good kid, right? And I'm a very conscientious person, you know, I'm the oldest, you know, I'm a rule follower, I'm good at bossing people around, you know, pretty much a perfectionist and, you know, straight A student and all of, you know, involved in things and that sort of thing. What's interesting to me, and I think escaped everybody's notice, and including my parents, and my own, is that how much of my being a good kid was rooted in a desire for acceptance, mm-hmm. and in a desire for affirmation. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that then is that as I got older and I went through my teen years, the surprise of this was how much of that was rooted in attention from boys. And even though I was very good at, you know, being the oldest and bossing people around, I also don't have a very good no internally. So, so we went through a whole period of, you know, my high school years where, you know, went on dates with boys and just having, you know, boundaries pushed, you know, again and again and again. And it's kind of, very interesting set of circumstances where, like, there's these little habits that just kind of built up. And unfortunately, you know, and I don't blame my parents, you know, in any way, shape, or form. My parents were married very young, you know, so high school, meeting somebody in high school was just part and parcel of,
right,
you know,
right.
high school. So, but, you know, I think in some sense, like, you know, I was part of a, you know, I think it was part of an era where it just didn't take marriage. Like, we were, I think my parents' era, they took marriage seriously.
Right.
You know, coming into high school, that was something I think people were thinking about, mm-hmm. And not the case in my era. So, So anyway, so we, you know, so these were these kind of little, these build up. I went to school in Annapolis. So I went to college, graduated again, you know, class valedictorian and, you know, again, all the accolades that, you know, one would think for a good kid. And I went to school in Annapolis, Maryland, at a small school called St. John's College. It's not Catholic and it's not religious, despite the name. but I went there because they have a really interesting Great Books program. They were a kind of forerunner in that. And I think what happened while I was there was that I had all of these habits, you know, these small, what seemingly small, but, you know, incremental pushes toward vice explode on me when I was there. So, you know, as a freshman, you're away from home for the first time. I wasn't really going to church. You know, again, it's a small school. It's not religious in any way, shape, or form. There was a Christian fellowship on campus, but I think somebody right off the bat told me, oh, you don't want to hang out with them, you know, and being somebody looking for affirmation all the time, like, oh, yes, I'm too cool for that. And, you know, in downtown Annapolis, within walking distance, there's a Presbyterian church, which I wasn't interested in. There was the Episcopal church, which I wasn't interested in, and a Catholic church, which I wasn't interested in. So yeah. I just stopped going to church.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and then also consequently, very interesting set of circumstances there is that the school's curriculum is so unique. It's not like normal school. Mm-hmm. And I had, unknown to me, I had two things going on. I had undiagnosed ADHD and I had undiagnosed bipolar disorder. So I hit a period of my life where all of a sudden I couldn't ride on natural intelligence alone. I had to actually have study skills. I had never had study skills before in my life, which is crazy. I had a 4.0.
Right, right.
And I was like, how does this happen? Well, this happens with people with ADHD. I think any of the educators could probably tell.
Right.
Yeah. So I hit a point in school where I wasn't doing well. The first time in my life, I was struggling with school. I was, you know, coming into the fullness of, you know, womanhood. And I think with that is like, you know, when you're fully growing up and people with bipolar disorder, that's when it really starts escalating and you start really experiencing that. Again, not going to church, away from parents. And this is just a perfect storm. And so, yes, into that, looking for affirmation. You know, I'm a good kid, but I'm also looking for affirmation. And we had, you know, unfortunately, what ended up happening was that I fell into a very, very problematic dating relationship. And when I say problematic, I would say, I think it, I had to be very careful because this is a small school and people know each other. But I would say, I think it began, I think, with good intentions on both sides and then devolved into the kind of relationship that people warn you about. Oh. And that is where I ended up. I, you know, cycled back around, you know, my freshman year in this, you know, I wasn't friendless in this. I had somebody tried to intervene at one point. Ended up, he actually was related to me. We did not know that until we got to college. And I was like, oh, you're a Spradley from Texas. My grandmother was a Spradley from Texas. They're all related to each other. And it turned out we were. He tried to intervene. But I went home that summer, totally in the grips of this. I went to church with my folks. And I remember standing in the narthex, the center doors were open to the sanctuary. And, you know, here I am in my home church. This has always been a very safe and loving environment for me. I felt God's love there. And I remember standing at those open doors and thinking, I am so unhappy. I am so unhappy. which is, I think, probably, you know, where we, you know, where that that realization and that being able to articulate that as a 19-year-old girl who had just had this, you know, I think college really is a major upheaval for most people.
And to be able to, the grace of someone being able to come to that realization. There's a certain fear of even admitting that to yourself at a low point in your life, right? And so the grace of that, you know.
And the grace of it, you know, again, among, you know, my church family. You know, it was, there was so much shame, and I did so many things that were very shameful. It was, my family was, I don't think they knew what to do. I'm the boyfriend, my boyfriend had visited at one point, and I'm surprised my dad didn't kill him. I'm being facetious, but, you know, this was, you know, I don't think, nobody knew what to do, really. I was so deep in this. And so anyway, I went back to, you know, returned to school that fall. Again, you know, but I had a wonderful moment in God's providence. I had a friend who, evangelical, and she asked me, would you like to be my accountability partner? And I tell you what, this was like the last thing I wanted at that point in my life. But because I'm not good at saying no, I said, okay.
Yeah.
And so we met and we were accountability partners, except that I was not telling her things. There were, and because I have a sensitive conscience, I knew I wasn't telling her things, and this bothered me. So we had this. This was something that we did for probably the first, you know, month and a half of school. I started slowly spending a little bit of time with the Christian Fellowship folks, and I knew that they, because they also did not, were not interested in the churches in downtown Annapolis, they took a van to go to, you know, a different church, and they would just all go together. And one morning in October, I woke up late. I slept through, you know, my alarm to go get on the van to go with them. And so I stumbled into the school cafeteria for lunch, and I happened to see a friend of mine, Trent, and he was eating lunch, and he was, I knew he was Catholic, and he went to Mass at 12:30. And in Annapolis, St. Mary's Annapolis has Mass all day long. It's one of those parishes where, you know, there's just, they have to have Mass all day long because they have that many people in town. And so they had a 12:30 Mass, and I said, hey, can I go with you? And he's like, sure, that's fine. Yeah, come on with me. So I went to Mass, and we were joined by another student, and we walked together down to St. Mary's. And I had never been inside a Catholic church before. This was my very first time.
Yeah.
Looking back, I would say this was my first time being in the presence. I would say it was the Eucharist. I had never been in the presence of the Eucharist before. So I walked in. And we sit down, and the Mass starts, and I have no idea what's going on. I just do whatever Trent's doing. And then the homily, Father was preaching. I don't remember a word that he said. But in the middle of the homily, I had, all of a sudden, I heard God the Father speaking. I had interlocution. And the experience was a profound sense of fatherly care, but the words were ones of rebuke. And the words were, what are you doing with your life? And then I broke down sobbing. I'm just weeping in the middle of the homily. And of course, Trent's next to me like, you know, like, we don't have called, you know, like, we don't have come to Jesus moments here. There's no altar call. And I'm like, what is going on? And I just wept all the way through Mass. And we're walking home, and I'm like, I have to break up with him. I have to break up with him. And I walked, marched. I don't think I could have done this. I wouldn't have had the courage to. I was in the middle of a relationship where I was in a codependent position of, you know, again, all the things that you they warn you about. Mm-hmm. I marched straight to my boyfriend's dorm room. He was still sleeping. I knocked on the door. I went in and I said, I have to break up with you because God told me to. And of course, he was like floored because he was not expecting that. So, and then I just walked out.
Wow.
And that was that. And then the fallout began.
Okay. You know, I was thinking, you know, backing up just a little bit, what in the Church of God, I mean, one of these big meta questions in terms mm-hmm. of becoming Catholic and the different Christian traditions, the different theologies, is just what do you do with your shame? What do you do with sin?
Yeah.
Right. And that's one of these deep questions that if, you know, we all have the experience of sin and we all have the desire to follow God. But then when you've made mistakes, what do you do with that? You know, and how was that view? What did you do with your? Did you just apologize to God and the Church of God? How did that, was that wrestled with on a practical, emotional level?
Yeah, that's a great question. Did we have any sort of confession or public confession? I think, you know, we definitely had, at least at the church I grew up in, we had, you know, an altar, you know, like a kneeler mm-hmm. at the front. Oftentimes people, when they had these moments, would go mm-hmm. and pray. I don't think there was ever like a sense of a public confession. There's definitely like receiving counsel, you know, pastors right. are of course being pastors. For me, because there wasn't a Church of God nearby, mm-hmm. at least not that I was aware of. I didn't have a car yeah. anyway, so I couldn't have gone. You know, the Christian fellowship ended up being very important, mm-hmm. but I was a mess. Mm-hmm. I was an absolute wreck. And I think these are the wages of sin, right? It's like we have yeah. this moment of conversion.
Yeah.
You know, God reached into a dark situation and pulled me out.
Right.
Like just plucked right out of that. And, but at the same time, like I was an absolute wreck. Yeah. And I think the poor Christian fellowship, you know, friends were like, what to do with yeah. her? I mean, she is like, off her rocker. I ended up going home. That was my answer to this. I withdrew from school after the end of the fall semester. I went home. I lived with my folks. I enrolled at Oregon State. My mom's an accountant at Oregon State. She's been an accountant there for a long, long time. She's getting close to retirement. And I just went to school. And tried and lived at home and was just, you know, trying to get back into church. And that was, you know, I needed to be with my family.
Yeah.
But at some point, because St. John's is weird, it's a weird place with a weird curriculum, I missed it. Mm. I missed the school. I didn't miss the circumstances yeah. that of being with certain people. But I did miss the curriculum. I missed the school environment.
Yeah, and I was going to actually ask you earlier, because we know that there's a literary trajectory here. Mm-hmm. Like what got you into that program in the first place?
Oh, I got a mailing from them.
Okay.
And it was so different than all the other mailings I had received. You know, normally, you know this phenomenon, right? You get college yeah. mailings, and it's big, glossy brochures, and yeah. somebody with backpacks under a tree, yeah. you know, and it looks, you yeah. know, they all look the same. And I'm a graphic designer. I do graphic mm-hmm. design on the side, mm-hmm. and so I did notice these things.
Yeah.
and I got a mailing from St. John's, and it was a little book, like this big. And it was brown. It was like a brown paper bag. But on the front, it said the following teachers will return to St. John's this year. And it lists the program authors, starting with Homer and ending with Einstein, you know, and it just lists the the authors. And then you open it up and it's mostly narrative about the program, the history, what would they do, what classes are like, and that sort of thing. So I said, well, this is really different. Mm-hmm. And I took it to a teacher of mine, a teacher. He was from, so again, I'm from Oregon. And from a fairly, not rural area, but just a fairly kind of standard, like I grew up in the middle of grass seed country. And He was from Boston. He was the son of an Irish, you know, construction worker and a washerwoman, like literally like people off the boat. And he's like, and he went to Harvard and his brother went to MIT, you know, I mean, like, oh my gosh, like, I can't do a Southie accent, but that was it. Yeah. And I mean, we just worshiped the ground he walked on, and because he was so different. But he said, I've heard of this school. You should think about that. And so I did. And that's how I ended up there.
Had you been into literature or art up to that point?
Yeah, I love reading. I had at that time, too, I had just finally made the transition from YA, young adult fiction, into real, like, literature. And so that definitely was the gateway drug, if you will, was Jane Austen. And so I had just discovered Pride and Prejudice. So I was, you know, yeah. All of a sudden I'm reading all of Austen and
so
then
good,
moving
yeah.
on from there.
Yeah.
So definitely was really important yeah. in, you know, putting me on a trajectory
sure.
saying, I want to read the great books.
Okay. So you took that time away with your family going to Oregon, but you kind of felt this call back to St. John's.
Yeah. Okay. And I did. I went back. At St. John's, they don't accept transfer credits because of the nature of the program. So I re-entered the stream with the class behind me. And that class had a much different dynamic. And so, I mean, it's about 100, 120 students per year. And they just had a positive environment, like just feel about them. The classes were very good. I was in a good spot. I came back in ready to study. I think it had taken me those first year and a half. I told you I was struggling in school.
Right.
It took a long time to learn to read again. Mm-hmm. You know, how to read closely. I'd never done that. I was really literally like, I remember when I first read a sentence, we were reading Thomas Aquinas at that point. Say Thomas Aquinas. I remember reading a sentence and thinking, I just decoded every single word in that sentence as I read it. I didn't have to circle back. I'm like, again, straight A student in high school. Like, I don't know how this happened, but it did. So I went back in ready to study, ready to learn, in a really good spot. And so rejoined that. Yeah. The other thing that happened was that I met the Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
So I never pieced together my conversion moment, this
right.
moment of profound conversion with being Catholic. I think at some point I was like, oh yeah, that just happened to happen. It just so happened
right.
that it was at the Catholic Church and that's where God met me. It doesn't really have anything to do with Catholicism. And I learned that that was wrong. It was actually wrong.
Well, maybe before we launch into that, maybe that'd be a good place for a break.
Sure, that sounds
but
good.
I was thinking about that fact that, again, this sense of, like, what do I, as a Christian, what do I do with shame and guilt and sin and
mm-hmm.
the significance of having this encounter in the midst of the sacrament of the Mass, right? There seems like there's a significance there because I think the sacraments are the answer to that,
mm-hmm.
right? That despite our best efforts, our best desires to do God's will, to be a good Christian, like we need divine help. Like we need God to reach down and give
mm-hmm.
us the remedy. And so we have that in sacraments. Well, we'll explore that more.
Okay.
So let's take a little break. We'll be back in just a few minutes to hear the rest of Rhonda's story. I want to remind you, as always, that if you are someone who's thinking about becoming Catholic, if you're exploring some of these questions, you've maybe had an experience of the Mass or of Catholic teaching that's brought questions to your mind. We want to be journeying with you. We want to help you on this journey, answer your questions, pray with you and for you. And so if you go to chnetwork.org, we have a whole network and resources for you to help you on your way. A newsletter, retreats, an online community, and again, especially staff members who want to hear your story and help you in any way we can as you continue on your journey. So check that out at chnetwork.org. We'll be back again in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Rhonda's story. See you then. Well, welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Rhonda Ortiz. She's a former Church of God of the Anderson, Indiana strain of,
mm-hmm.
the Church of God. And before we get back into the story, we're going to pick you up. You've gone back to St. John's and you've met some Catholics and you're reconnecting to that conversion experience. But before we jump back into it, I just want to mention a couple of the projects that you're involved mm-hmm. in. You're recently you became the editor-in-chief of Dappled Things magazine. And in a line or two, what's Dappled Things about?
So Dappled Things is a literary magazine. Okay. We publish fiction, nonfiction, so short fiction, poetry, visual art. We do book reviews as well. And we are entering our 20th year. Nice. So it's a wonderful, wonderful project. It's great. It's
wonderful.
Just really great.
Yeah. So that's one. And then you're also involved in publishing, an editor. What's the imprint called?
The imprint is called Chrism Press. Chrism, I am one of a handful of co-founders for that. Okay. An imprint of a larger another company, an existing publishing company. And we publish young adult and adult fiction, novels, from Catholic and Orthodox Christian voices. So nice. So if you're looking for Catholic fiction that's being written today, we do a range of popular to literary. Mm-hmm. So we have big, wide open doors. And awesome. If you're looking for something to read, we would totally welcome you to, come check out our website.
Very good. Yeah. Well, and Rhonda, you're a novelist as well yourself. And so we'll have the website up there, rhondaortiz.com. You can find out more about Rhonda's projects. And I know, again, there's a literary trajectory to your story. We were talking before the show about, even your writing now is sort of, the continuing part of the journey as you kind of work through things and everything. But going back to where we left off, you'd gone back to this great books program at St. John's, and you're meeting some Catholics, but you're also, kind of making this connection or maybe considering the connection that you'd had this experience of God the Father, this question, what are you doing with your life, in the midst of the Mass, a Catholic Mass, and whether there was significance to that. So, so what happened next?
So, I think it was, you had asked, what do we do about shame? What do we do with guilt? And I think what's interesting about this period of time is that I had this conversion. I had this return. Yeah. Like the prodigal daughter has come home. If you ever think about the story of the prodigal son, somebody recently was saying, what was it like on day two? they wake up, they're having breakfast, like, so how was
leftovers from the fatted calf.
Right. And then you're like, how was that time feeding pigs? But there's this whole period of time where I was still learning good habits. I still had vices. I still slipped, I still had these kind of regressions. And, at the same time though, my meeting Catholics, always so funny. I had a friend of mine who is now a Dominican friar. We worked together in the school's art gallery. And I walked in. It was one of the first experiences of meeting him. He was reading a book. I'm sorry. It was Martin Luther, Hitler's spiritual ancestor. And I looked at that book and I said, you can't read that. And he's like, what? Somebody gave it to me. I was kind of curious. And I was like, what? Fortunately, he turns out to be a good guy. So, he was just reading a book that somebody had given to him. So that went from there. So I started meeting Catholics. And slowly starting to learn what this meant. And I think they heard my story. My guess is they heard my story and were like, her. She had an experience. Yeah. She had an experience of the Eucharist. It took me a while to get there. I had a good girlfriend who was a faithful Catholic. And, I started asking her questions. We went to adoration together. St. Mary's Annapolis, even at that time, had perpetual adoration going, I think at that point, for 10 years. And those of you who've been to Annapolis, those of our viewers who've been to Annapolis, know St. Mary's is a very beautiful church. And the adoration chapel is in this crypt, in the crypt of the church. And you access us from the outside. And adjacent to that is this beautiful garden. And and including a children's garden, there's a statue of St. Joseph holding the child Jesus. And my friend Beth said, she showed it to me, and she's like, I love St. Joseph. He took care of Mary and Jesus. And the way she just said it, I had never thought about it like that. I was like, I love St. Joseph too. But for me, that was a moment not of, it wasn't an argument.
Right.
It was a piece of imagination that she was able to picture St. Joseph in a way that I had never pictured him. You know, it was like a real human being. This was a real person. It wasn't just a story from the Bible. It was, he was real, and he took care of Christ and his mother. Right. So, and then we went there into the Adoration Chapel, and I walked into what I would argue to say was the strongest spiritual presence I had ever walked into. I had never, you know, I was like, oh, there is something here. And I feel the weight. It was like the weight of glory and the weight of my own sin all in one. And I sat down, I was like, I am going to test the spirits. That's what the scripture says, test these spirits. And so, you know, and I started going to adoration. I also, the same friend, and we were talking about the imagination, and I told you this story beforehand, but we had, you know, not an argument. Not an argument or a logical argument for why Catholicism is true, but a piece of imagination that allowed me to accept the moral teaching of the church. It was February of my junior year. We were reading Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, so German Enlightenment philosophy in the middle of the dreariest month.
Delightful.
It was great. And every Johnny, I think, in this, whoever watches this, is going to know exactly what I'm talking about. And I was spiraling. And like I mentioned, I have bipolar disorder. I was having a little bit of a rough year my junior year. I just didn't know. I had no way of managing it because I didn't know. I was spiraling. You can't read Kant anyway without feeling a little bit down in the dumps. And then, you know, you put something like that on top of it. It just was not good. And the same friend, Beth, recognized the symptoms. She comes in to my dorm room and she hands me a battered paperback and says, here, read this. And I looked at it, and I was a literature snob at this point. So I'm like, what are you giving me? Like, what is that? And she gave it to me. It was the original version of Cheaper by the Dozen.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, I'll put Kant aside. Why not? You know, happily. And I read Cheaper by the Dozen. And I hadn't laughed so hard in so long.
Which is a book about a huge family, tons of kids,
this
kind of, you know,
antics.
Eccentric family. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a delightful little book.
It's a delightful book. It's not a piece of great literature.
Right.
It's just fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I read this. And so not only did it save me from death by Kant, but it actually opened up a place in my imagination for large family life. Now, the Gilbreths, who are featured in the book, were not Catholic.
Right.
But when you have a family of 12 kids, and you talk about Catholicism, and you say, you're a woman, I'm a woman, right? And, like, you say, being open to life, like, that makes demands. That's going to set a trajectory, you know, if I were to get married. And, you know, and it did.
And that was a different trajectory than what you'd kind of grown up with?
Right. I can't think of very many families that I knew that were large. I had no imagination for it. And so this actually opened up the imagination for me. It was fiction. It was popular fiction. It was humor that opened up a space to say, hey, this might not be so bad. So I did that. And then at the end of that year, a friend of mine came into the church. I went to the vigil service. And of course, 9 readings at the vigil service. And I thought, I am hearing more scripture proclaimed here than I have ever heard in church.
Interesting.
And this was also preceded by a sort of frustration with the, you know, the non-denom church I was going to with some friends. You know, I felt like I was being manipulated by the music. And so I had that frustration piece. And then I go to this Vigil Mass, and of course it's glorious. The Vigil Mass is glorious. And
manipulated, like emotionally.
Emotionally manipulated. Yeah, I just didn't feel like it was authentic, you know? And I think there was a piece of me that was like, I need something more.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm going to adoration. I'm feeling frustrated with, you know, the evangelical worship. You know, I'm feeling like there's got to be something more here. I'm missing something. And then I go to the vigil. I'm like, whoa, this is amazing. And so I'm like, I need to discern this. So it was never like an outright rejection of my past. And fortunately, I went through RCIA, or OCIA as it's called now. Fortunately, the deacon who was leading it, he told us, he said, bring the best of what you had with you.
Yeah, right.
And that was a real saving grace because I never felt animosity toward the people who taught me about Christ in the first place.
Well, and how you described, you know, with these, some of these different topics, you know, the imaginative route through some of these topics. I mean, sometimes the barriers between Protestants and Catholics are much bigger due to kind of getting caught up in the words, right? You know, like, I mean, you gave the example of St. Joseph earlier, right? A lot has been made of the saints and what they are, what they're not in apologetic discourse for the past 500 years. But if you just step back and set those aside for a moment and just ask the question, you know, who was St. Joseph? What did he do? Is he alive? You know, is he a saint? What does that mean? Well, then of course you'd have an admiration for him. You'd have a certain, you would revere him. You'd have a reverence for this holy man and what he did, not because he on his own is something great, but because in Christ, in God, it's a beautiful thing. Like, why wouldn't I revere the saints? Why wouldn't I love the saints?
Right.
And so it's like the route of the imagination sort of bypasses a lot of the battles over words, as St. James warns us against, and gets to the heart of the issue, which is, now this is actually a very intuitive human doctrine, this reverence for the saints.
Yeah. Right. And like the imagination of the closeness of heaven.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this was, you know, that heaven is far more than what we, you know, what we initially, we can't imagine what it is. And but that the idea that heaven is present to us is, again, I think for me, is a piece of imagination. It's not an it's not an argument.
Right.
And I love arguments. I'm a lay Dominican. You know, give me St. Thomas Aquinas, really. Like, I read Enlightenment philosophy and, you know, bickered with it, you know? So, like, it's not that I don't like learning or the word, you know, the word or, you know, it's not that I don't appreciate apologetics, but I think for me, those moments of conversion were actually imaginative ones.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something to that, almost like it's like two sides of the lungs or something like that. Like, we need the intellectual side, the word, the arguments, the logic. But it's almost like you have to breathe in both sides. Otherwise, you kind of trap yourselves in the words sometimes. And sometimes you need to step back and catch the vision, you know, within which, you know, the arguments take on more sense or they have a better context.
Yeah.
So I think that's true with a lot of those topics, you know, that you talked about.
Yeah. And I think from there, you know, I spent that year discerning, my senior year discerning. I went to RCIA and then something really wonderful happened, was I met my husband. So my husband has been on this show.
That's right. Back in 2015, I think.
Yeah, that's right. With your father. And he's a revert and, you know, cradle Catholic. And so he was a first year master's student when I was a senior. So St. John's has a very small master's program. And so Jared, my husband, had come to do that. And so my friend, who I mentioned before about the Luther book, knew every Catholic on campus, including some of the grad students. And so so we had, you know, I had met him because, you know, I had friends who knew him. But we really didn't connect until one January morning. Same friend. And I were bickering like cats and dogs, like brother and sister. And I don't even remember what we were fighting about. But all I know is I said, he's like, let's go to the chapel. And I said, I don't want to go anywhere with you. He's like, we're going. I said, fine. And we marched down, you know, and it's cold. And you know, we get to the church and I'm very cold and my nose is running. So I said, I'll see you in there. I got to go to the bathroom and get a tissue. And when I came out of the bathroom, I'm walking down the church, the corridor at the rectory, and I'm about to go out to the Adoration Chapel. And who walks in but Jared Ortiz? And we stopped and we had, you know, ended up having a half hour conversation right there. Now he had been, and he told your husband this, mm-hmm. he had been praying about girls. Mm-hmm. He'd been like, God, please work out this woman thing. You know, he wanted to find a wife. And we bumped into each other. And I went into the chapel. And it turns out, you know, Jared's side of it was, oh, you mean someone like that who goes to the chapel on a Friday afternoon? Little did he know that I did not want to go, you know, that particular afternoon. Mm-hmm. But I did. And then, you know, one thing led to another. Jared knew very quickly he wanted to marry me. I think, you know, I literally was dropped in his lap. And at that point, you know, I was starting to receive, you know, I'm receiving confession. I'm discerning. My husband is the first man that I could ever imagine myself having children with. Hmm. That was the distinct turn for me, right. Was like family life. I could see myself having a family with him. And so, and that was a really important moment. And again, that's a point of the imagination.
Yeah.
I can imagine myself having a family with him. Jared, very determined personality, you know, went and met my parents, bought a ring, held on to it, but he waited until, so I came into the church, again, 2004. Yeah. This is 2024 right now. This is my 20th year.
Yeah.
And, and I had my Easter vigil. I was received. Everything was beautiful. My sister came out for it. And my sister tells me he was fiddling that ring box the entire service. 15 minutes after church, he proposed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I got some sacraments and the promise
beautiful.
Of another.
Yeah.
You know, his joke was he didn't want to propose to a Protestant. but, you know, in honesty, he was just waiting for me to finish my process and yeah. then before embarking on the next one.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
All right. So, when did you get married?
December 2004. Okay. And we went to Rome.
Okay.
For our honeymoon. Thank you to my father-in-law who gave us that gift. We actually had a papal audience with John Paul II.
Wow.
We did have a blessing. That was 4 months before he passed away. And I tell you, he was late for the service and he was very tired. You could tell. Mm-hmm. He was very tired. And at a couple points in the service, at one point, you could say he was falling asleep and he took his hand and he pounded his chair, forced himself up, you know. I mean, we were just like, he was so determined to be there and to make it. You know, and of course he had Parkinson's, you know, it was really bad at that point. I think he was speaking, he was reading something and then he was drooling and he just, at the end of it, he took his handkerchief and he wiped his mouth and just folded it and just folded his hands like this. Like I am just full of dignity right now. Like it didn't matter. Like my body is falling apart, but I have dignity. And, we were just so impressed with that. Wow. So yeah, we did receive a papal blessing right before he passed away.
Wonderful.
So
you began your Catholic life together. And I know we have a lot to talk about in terms of what's happened since then, in terms of your literary work, the projects, but talk about, you know, your life as a Catholic with your husband and what you guys have, you know, what's happened since there, and then let's talk about your work.
Yeah. So I think what's really important to realize is that in coming from a relationship, you know, coming out of into my, you know, young woman year, my woman, you know, my as a young woman, coming out of a really horrible relationship, you know, and then working through that and then going into marriage, of course, is that this does not go away. And again, these are the wages of sin, you know? So like experiencing God's love and forgiveness, experiencing his mercy, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Right.
And so, you know, my husband and I have put in many, many years of both, you know, his own background. And again, you can talk about, you know, go watch his episode,
right.
go look it up.
Yeah.
And my background, and you know, and I think this is a really beautiful thing about marriage. It's not that you have to be perfect going in or that you have to find the perfect spouse,
right.
but you have to be willing to work on your own stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if you can do that together, that is what makes us holy. It's not it's not being a saint at the get go. It's not doing the right things. I had to learn that one. Hmm. You know, I was like, I'm going to be a good, you know, perfect Catholic. you know, whatever that meant in my imagination. And had to learn, like, you know, slowly those things were broken apart. We had 5 years of infertility. You know, we thought we were going to have a big family. Had 5 years of infertility before we found out we were expecting our first. So things like that, you know, had really shaped us in humility and being open to things. For circumstances in my own family led to me getting a bipolar diagnosis. So I got to, you know, starting to like understand myself. Like, why do I struggle with these certain things? Oh, I have a I have an illness. My body is not working. Okay, let's get that treated so that I can grow in virtue without fighting myself.
Right.
So there were things like that along the way that came out of, they were the fruit of much prayer, much talk, much, you know, providential circumstances in my life. One of the biggest jumps after getting a diagnosis, one of the biggest jumps was when I discovered writing fiction. I was always a writer,
right,
but I was never a fiction writer. And when my oldest was little, I was, we were living with my folks at the time because Jared was writing his dissertation. And Dad's like, just get it done. Come live at home and don't work. And I was dozing off because I had a newborn. This is morning prayer. But I wasn't really praying. I was dozing. all of a sudden, I had this kind of memory of something that had happened, you know, in a visit to Chicago way back when. And all of a sudden, I had characters and a setting and people talking in my head. And now normally, this is grounds for going to the hospital. But in this case, this was fiction. These were characters. And I ended up talking to my husband about it. I'm like, this is happening. I don't know. And he was like, Rhonda, this sounds right. You should do this. You should pursue this. So we spent a couple years writing together. And then I spent the next 7 years writing manuscripts, putting them in the desk drawer, writing manuscript, put in the desk drawer until, you know, I finally had a story that I was like, I think this is going somewhere. The process of writing that story. So this story, it's a historical, it is a love story. You know, first and foremost, there's also politics and spies and, you know, George Washington and company makes an appearance because it's set in 1793. It's a lot of fun. And, but it's a love story first and foremost. And it forced me to think through things because I had both the female and male perspective. It forced me to think through things from a male perspective. This was immensely healing for my marriage. I was thinking about theology of the body. I was trying to imagine everything from a man's perspective and trying to be like, you know, like, what is this? You know, like, what is motivating this? You know, like, I'm trying to understand it and respect it. And then I would write these scenes where I would be struggling, you know, with writing from my character's perspective. And I would talk to my husband about it. And he would listen to me go on for half an hour. And then finally, I would pause to let him talk. And he would say, yeah, that doesn't sound like something a dude would do. And I'm like, stomp off really angry and then come back finally. And I'd be like, okay, what would a dude do? Mm-hmm. Tell me, you know? So we had this immense amount of time and it was very healing.
Yeah.
It was very healing for me on a very emotional and imaginative level, very healing. And it, you know, and I think when I have my readers, I have readers, you know, eventually that book is published, and the second book is published. I'm working on the third. But when that book was published, I did, you know, for some readers, it's a fun read. That's it. There's nothing more than that. It's just a great fun read. You know, for other readers, though, have picked up on that hard work that I did. The characters are not my husband and me. There's nothing about right. This. This is not my situation, but they've picked up somehow those resonances of all the work that I, you know, this process
sure,
of healing.
Sure.
And I've had readers email me say, oh, that one sentence from Mrs. Robb, that really just switched something in my marriage. Like it just brought something into perspective. And I'm like, yeah. God be praised.
Yeah.
Like really, I didn't know that about your situation when I wrote it, mm-hmm. you know.
And my kids often ask me, you know, is this story true? I have very avid readers in my family and trying to explain to them the difference between, well, depends on what you mean here, right? There's historical truth, like did this actually happen in our mm-hmm. world, you know, mm-hmm. you know? But then there's other way, other senses of the word true. Mm-hmm. And all good stories have a deeper sort of truth, and that they resonate with the kind of world we live in, mm-hmm. the kind of beings that we are, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you come at life thinking, you know, nihilistically, that there's no meaning, no purpose, no creator, it's just a stream of events that just happen with no rhyme or reason. That's a particular way of looking at life and experiences. But story always implies a storyteller. It always implies an arc. It always implies this is going someplace, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's something to that. I think that's one of the reasons that we resonate with stories, is we kind of recognize that, no, that's the way the world is. The world, it has this story characteristic to it. You mm-hmm. know?
And I think, like, the better formed we are as Catholics, the truer the story, mm-hmm. which is so funny, right? It's this is a fictional story, mm-hmm. but there's more truth imbued in it because of the worldview. And it's not necessarily that I'm writing, you know, I necessarily want to write something didactic.
Right.
Although my characters are on a journey, but they start out as Protestants. And so then now I have to write Protestants, and Protestants are didactic sometimes, you know. So, like, they themselves are having, you know, especially in Boston at the time, was a very interesting time religiously in the late 1700s and early 1800s. So they're going through their own religious revolution. I have to deal with that mm-hmm. As a setting.
Yeah.
But that as Catholics, we bring ourselves to the writing, and when we bring ourselves as readers to the book, mm-hmm. we see things in it,
yeah.
you know, that it's that the story speaks truths and is a playground or sandbox maybe for the formation of, you know, both our viewpoint. It opens up, like I said, you know, with Cheaper by the Dozen, opened mm-hmm. up a scope. It opened up an area of life that I had never been able to see, you know, or, you know, since most stories are dealing with character arcs, you're always dealing with the moral imagination.
Right.
Right. You know, that a character is either going, a character is placed in circumstances that are going to demand something of him. And so either he's going to rise to the occasion and grow through this
right.
in order to, you know, deserve the girl or whatever, mm-hmm. or decline.
Yeah. Yeah. It rings with truth because we recognize, yeah. oh, yeah, that's the kind, the names might be different, the places might be, you know, but that's the kind of world that I do live in. Right.
Right.
And that's part of the journey is grappling with that. We only have a couple minutes left. And so I want to make sure that we, you know, bring us up to speed, you know, the projects that you're working on now, mm-hmm. Dappled Things. Tell us about your work. Yeah.
Okay. So, so again, I wear a number of hats.
Yes. Yeah.
So there's my writing work, which is one hat. Mm-hmm. The Dappled Things, I have been involved with them for about a decade. I was always on the production end. Mm-hmm. And then recently, our longtime editor in chief stepped down, and she took a position actually with Word on Fire, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm really happy for her.
Yeah.
And so I was asked to take her place. Now, my predecessor, Katie Carl, is just so wonderful, so kind, and she's also incredibly smart. And so, of course, I was like, but this is good. This has been a very good thing for me. I do have editorial experience, what I'll talk about mm-hmm. in just a second, and has been just an opportunity for me to meet new people, to work in different genres, you know, to work with poetry, to work with nonfiction, things that I really like, but I haven't had a chance to work with as an editor. I also am a founding editor of Chrism Press. That is an initiative that came out of my own story plays a role in that, because I was shopping my manuscript around, and friends of mine own a publishing company. They were Christian at the time, and in the process of acquiring it, said, "Hey, we should start a Catholic imprint." And so myself and Karen Yulow, who I met through Dappled Things, and then another one of the existing editors, we came together and we founded this with my friends, the owners, and it's just off and running.
Wonderful.
We have, I think we're close, and with everything in production, we're in the 2 dozens in titles, which is great for a small thing.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, can people find out all about those different projects at RhondaOrtiz.com?
Yeah, you know, I've got links around. Yeah. Otherwise, just Google it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Rhonda.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. It's always a delight when we can talk kind of almost the meta discussion here about story itself, right? Because what makes the show so special is that this is that we're in God's story. He's writing the story. We're discovering in our lives the story that He has placed us in and that He's calling us forward into. So it's always a delightful conversation when we can kind of get meta about that a little bit. But again, you can check out Rhonda's work at RhondaOrtiz.com, and we'll be back again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless you. See you then.